Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, February 1st, 2018. South Sudan Civil Society Coalition call on IGAD mediators to push the warring parties to end violence.
The people of South Sudan do not want to continue in war again, at least the ordinary citizens who are bearing the cost of this violence. And so, the role of the mediators should be to help the parties to the conflict to reach an agreement.
And the International Organization for Migration issues an appeal for millions of dollars to help needy South Sudanese.
We're doing our best to reach populations in further areas, in remote areas throughout the country, to provide longer-term wash and prevention of gender-based violence. So, for example, we have an ongoing response in an area called Bugari, which is south of Wau.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Civil society activists are calling on all parties to order their forces to adhere to the cessation of hostility agreement as South Sudan's warring parties prepare for phase two of the IGAD-mediated high-level revitalization forum scheduled for next week. South Sudan Civil Society Forum, an umbrella group of more than 20 civil society groups, issued a statement yesterday calling on the warring parties to release political prisoners, prisoners of war and child soldiers. Gift Friday reports for VOA from Juba.
Civil society activists called on the warring parties to issue directives to field commanders to cease all hostilities and refrain from any unauthorized movement of forces. Rajab Mohandis, executive director of the South Sudan Network for Democracy and Elections, says South Sudanese were disappointed to see the cessation of hostilities agreement being violated by the warring parties just days after it was signed. But Mohandi says there has been progress in recent days.
We have been monitoring this, the implementation of the cessation of hostilities very closely. In the past, say, 1 week, the country has been largely silent, and that is quite positive. And so I wanted to say that the citizens should remain hopeful.
Mohandi says civil society activists are urging the parties to do more to ensure that their forces strictly abide by the terms of the agreement and hold any individual within who violates the ceasefire accountable. The statement also calls on the government to retract recent statements declaring that NGOs did not report violations.
When there is fighting in any part of this country, we don't take permission from them to run away from the violence. So we also don't need permission to speak out on these issues. As long as we have credible information, we have all the rights to share this information.
South Sudan Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Elia Lomoro recently warned NGOs against reporting ceasefire violations. Mohandis counters that NGOs should not be restricted because they are contributing to efforts to restore peace. He says civil society activists are helping the voiceless who cannot come to the table in Addis Ababa. The activists say the high-level revitalization forum risks joining the long list of failed peace processes in the history of South Sudan if the parties simply replicate models that have failed in the past, which have largely focused on power sharing and little else. Mohandi says the South Sudan Civil Society Forum developed principles to ensure that decisions about governance and security arrangements will serve the interests of the South Sudanese people.
There are six principles. The first one is inclusivity, that decision-making processes and institutions should be representative of the South Sudanese public. We also say that there should be integrity and good faith by the parties. This process should be geared towards nation building and national identity that will unify the people of South Sudan. This process should be governed in the principles of the rule of law and accountability. People who will lead the next transitional government should be competent enough to deliver on the commitments of the agreement.
Mohandi says the warring parties return to the negotiating table in Addis. South Sudanese must take ownership of the political process and ensure that all efforts contribute to sustainable peace.
To the mediators, we want to remind them that the people of South Sudan do not want to continue in war again, at least the ordinary citizens who are bearing the cost of this violence. And so, the role of the mediators should be to help the parties to the conflict to reach an agreement.
Muhandi says the sticking points in the round of the talks that open on Monday will be the restructuring of governance arrangement, transitional security arrangements, and enforcing the permanent ceasefire. He says this can be achieved if the leaders of all parties negotiate in good faith with a sincere intention to end the suffering of the people. Gift Friday for VOA News, Juba.
The International Organization for Migration is asking for a little over $100 million to provide life-saving assistance to displaced South Sudanese across the country this year. IOM says the money would reach more than 1 million displaced people and provide them with shelter, clean water, and sanitation services. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio has more from Juba.
Ashley McWagling, IOM's spokesperson in South Sudan, says the $103.7 million appeal is part of the 2018 humanitarian response plan to assist millions of displaced and hungry people across the country.
It might sound like too much money, but over 7 million people in South Sudan are in need of humanitarian assistance, which is more than one in two people. And this doesn't even include the 2 million people who have fled the country since the crisis began. So needs are high. We're seeing that they only get worse every year.
On top of that, McWagling says, a cholera endemic has continued since July 2016 and food insecurity is severe. Just last month, the humanitarian community in South Sudan requested $1.72 billion to provide life-saving humanitarian assistance to 6 million people across South Sudan in 2018. McWagling says if made available, her organization will use some of the money it receives to provide life-saving and recovery assistance to people sheltering in protection of civilian sites, especially in Wau and Bentiu, the two largest POC sites in the country.
This includes funding for shelter and non-food items, including leadership in the shelter, providing water, sanitation, and hygiene assistance for displaced, affected, and host communities in South Sudan. Providing health care, life-saving primary health care services in the sea sites as well as remote areas, in addition to providing psychosocial support.
McWagling says her organization is also implementing assistance programs for populations affected by the conflict who are in hard-to-reach areas.
We're doing our best to reach populations in further areas, in remote areas throughout the country to provide longer-term wash and prevention of gender-based violence. So, for example, we have an ongoing response in an area called Bugari, which is south of Wau, which you may know has been affected by the crisis since mid-2016.
By wash, McWagling is referring to water, sanitation, and hygiene. She says IOM is also working to help people in the disputed Abyei region.
You know, the area was affected by fighting prior to the current crisis in South Sudan. So through rebuilding infrastructure, helping to conduct conflict resolution among different communities. And we hope to sort of replicate this in other parts of South Sudan to try to build recovery in some transition in areas that may be seeing a bit of stability.
McWagling says IOM also works with other aid agencies like the World Food Program through a program called Displacement Tracking and Monitoring to identify displaced people and figure out the best way to get aid to them. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is also appealing for $175 million to provide life-saving assistance to more than 250,000 largely forgotten victims of the radical Islamic group Boko Haram. Lisa Schlein has the story for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The Boko Haram insurgency, which began in northeast Nigeria in 2009, has displaced more than 2 million people inside the country. It also has sent hundreds of thousands of people fleeing for their lives to neighboring Niger, Chad, and Cameroon since 2013. Nigerian military forces have recaptured much of the territory taken by Boko Haram, and their progress has largely diverted world attention away from the crisis. While it no longer makes headline news, UN refugee spokesman Baba Baloch tells Voice of America the Boko Haram insurgency continues to displace people, negatively affecting their lives.
So we're trying to remind the world that there's still hundreds and thousands of people who are displaced by it, affected by it, especially women and children. Let's not forget the whole movement is against education. So many schools being affected, and also it has devastated impact on all the community where this group is operating.
The Lake Chad Basin is one of the poorest and most forgotten regions in the world. The UNHCR says one of the most devastating side effects of the Boko Haram conflict is the alarming rise in food insecurity, affecting more than 7.2 million people. This, it says, has sent malnutrition levels soaring. The agency says Nigerian refugees continue to flee to very remote and impoverished communities where they live in dire conditions. The appeal aims to provide emergency food, shelter, health, education, and water and sanitation to more than 200,000 Nigerian refugees and to 75,000 residents in the communities hosting them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look on the media crackdown in Kenya. That story is coming up next.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the best compliment that someone has given you?
Someone told me that I have white teeth and I like it.
I felt good. Someone recognizing you that you have beautiful teeth, it makes you feel okay, feel loved.
They said I'm beautiful and it felt so good. Yeah, it feels so good to be called so. You're beautiful.
The best compliment is one that I got from my mom when she told me that I was a very hard-working person.
The best compliment was from my girlfriend. Yeah, she said I look nice to her. And actually, I felt good and happy.
The best compliment I've received in life was from work, 10 years award of service. I was given an award for having served for 10 years.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Kenya's highest court has ordered the government to restore transmission for the independent broadcasters taken off air Tuesday ahead of the opposition's swearing-in ceremony for its leader Raila Odinga as the people's president. The interior minister accused the media of being complicit in an effort to subvert the elected government and spark violence. Press freedom advocates say the government has gone too far. Muhammad Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Article 19, along with other human rights groups, took the government to court to challenge its decision to suspend the three leading independent TV stations over what the interior ministry said was security concerns. On Thursday, the High Court ruled that the stations must be restored to air pending a full hearing in the case, according to a tweet from KTN, one of the affected broadcasters. Henry Maina heads the East Africa Office of Article 19, a global NGO that promotes freedom of expression and information worldwide. He says Kenya has never witnessed such an attack on press freedom.
This is the lowest Kenya has ever come to in the last 30 or 40 years. We've never had any media shut down by the state. We used to have challenges with newspapers being banned, but a TV or radio station has never been shut down in Kenya. So this is the lowest the country has sunk in terms of media freedom in 21st century.
The government did not immediately respond to the ruling. Kenya's Interior Minister Fred Matiang'i said
Wednesday, the media houses will remain shut until investigations are over.
We will bring each one of the individuals involved in legal activities to book.
His words sparked fear and outrage in the local press community. Three journalists at the National Media Group, which runs one of the suspended TV stations, told VOA they spent the night in their office building after getting word of plainclothes police officers waiting for them outside. The state accuses the media of ignoring its advice to not air the opposition swearing-in ceremony in Nairobi. The three broadcasters were all planning to go ahead with live coverage at the time they were caught. Raila Odinga, speaking for the first time after his self-integration, said the government is taking away the gains the country has made. He made reference to KANU, the party that ruled Kenya for decades since independence.
The attack on the media, the arbitrary arrest of individuals, intimidation of the judiciary, divide and rule tactics, KANU is back. KANU is back, the force, and by a new name that we must fight. We fought for a long time to give this country a new constitution in 2010. That new constitution, together with all the freedoms that it entails, is under serious attack right now.
Odinga has refused to accept the results of an October presidential runoff, which he boycotted. Incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta was declared the winner. Odinga took a symbolic oath of office Tuesday as the so-called People's President. TJ Kajwang, the opposition MP who administered the oath, was brought in front of a judge Thursday, accused of treason and organising a public meeting without informing the authorities. VOA spoke to his lawyer, Nelson Harvey.
We looked at the charges, we talked to our client, we realised that he'd been tortured, he'd been moved around all over the town from one station to another station, and the intention was just to intimidate him.
On Thursday, the judge charged Kajwang with enabling Odinga to commit treason and ordered him released on bail of 50,000 Kenyan shillings, or about $500. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
From Kenya, we move to Cameroon, where Cameroon's president says he will destroy all terrorists whom he says are attempting to separate his country or using it as a hiding place for armed attacks on neighboring states. Paul Biya says he is open to dialogue with disgruntled communities with the English-speaking minority, but his military will deal with armed separatists fighting for the independence of the English-speaking region. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
President Paul Biya says it is his duty to ensure public order, social peace, the unity of the nation, and Cameroon's integrity, and so he has issued instructions that all those who have taken up arms, who perpetrate or encourage violence, should be fought relentlessly and held accountable for their crimes before the courts of law.
Nous allons également.
It is my firm belief that fast-tracking our decentralization process will enhance the development of our regions. To that end, I have ordered the implementation of the necessary measures to speedily give effect to this major reform. Will contribute towards consolidating the rule of law and open a new page in our democratic process.
Many Cameroonians had expected Biya to be lenient towards armed insurgents and invite them to the negotiation table. Biya said he requested the government engage in constructive dialogue with English speakers to seek solutions to their demands, but he added that he will destroy all those who have taken arms against the state, which he reiterated will remain one and indivisible. He, however, pledged to make Cameroon a decentralized unitary state by implementing decentralization as spelled out in the country's constitution. René Emmanuel Sadi, Cameroon's Minister of Territorial Administration and Decentralization, says the decentralization Biya spoke about encounters many challenges.
We started implementing this process effectively since 2010. But of course, we could ascertain the fact that there are still some difficulties, there are still some problems. The councils complain that the resources put at their disposal do not really allow them to respond to the needs of the populations and to the implementation of their projects.
Until a few years ago, Cameroon was referred to as a peace haven because it had never experienced major challenges. But the Boko Haram insurgency on its northern border with Nigeria that started 4 years ago has killed more than 25,000 people and displaced millions of people in Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria and Niger, according to the United Nations. The spillover of the carnage in the Central African Republic, CAR, is also felt on the Central African state's border with CAR, with repeated cases of kidnappings for ransom and attacks by armed men. Adolphe Debenchofo, governor of Cameroon's English-speaking Northwest region, says he supports Paul Biya's determination to eliminate the armed separatists so that schools can reopen and businesses pick up in the English-speaking areas of Cameroon more than 1 year after they were hampered by the crisis.
We are begging for peace and we are leaving no stone unturned to maintain long-lasting security, securing the population, asking the population to mobilize themselves to support government to make sure the economic activity, the social activity in the region come back to normalcy.
Biya said Cameroonians desire greater participation in managing their affairs, especially at the local level, and as such, he will make sure the constitution is respected fully. Cameroon will hold local council, parliamentary and presidential elections in 2018. Many hope the polls will be transparent. Biya has been president for 35 years, winning in elections opposition political parties say are always rigged to favor him. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
French President Emmanuel Macron is on his sixth trip to Africa since taking office last May. The French president is in Tunisia for a state visit today and then will head to Senegal tonight. In Dakar, he will co-host Global Partnership for Education Financing Conference with Senegal's president Macky Sall. Reporter Catherine Field spoke to VOA's Kim Louise about the focus of the French president's trip to Africa.
This has really been the continent that he's shown the most interest in. Certainly what Emmanuel Macron, the French president, is keen on is, first of all, security, terrorism, and supporting democracy. And that's why this state visit to Tunisia is so important for him, because he feels that the only way that France can support democracy is by France being there, being on the ground, investing in the infrastructure, and particularly in investing in the youth. Emmanuel Macron has taken up business leaders with him, and they have already said that France will give some 50 million euros in aid specifically for young unemployed people in Tunisia. And of course, his other main emphasis, which he pushes all the time, is education and education for women. That's also high on his agenda.
What is the expected reception of him being there? Are business leaders there willing to do business with France?
Very much so. They want French investment. He has come up with this idea that France will be able to invest some 500 million euros in aid between 2020 and 22. That's very positive. He's also floating the idea that France could perhaps renegotiate the debt that Tunisia owes to France and to have that, if you like, transferred into local investments, investments that will bring jobs. The other important issue for the Tunisians is to give an image to France that tourism is actually open and up and running again. France provides you a lot of the tourist traffic into Tunisia, and with the security problems in the country over the last few years, it really has started to bite into the Tunisian economy. So certainly you're giving the idea that Tunisia is open, the tourism industry is back up there again, and that security has been reestablished. That is essentially what the Tunisian business people want.
Will there be any focus on migration and the migrant crisis?
Indeed, this is another aspect of pretty much everywhere that Emmanuel Macron goes nowadays, whether it be in Africa or around Europe, the migrant crisis. Let's not forget that Tunisia is not far by boat to Lampedusa, this Italian island in the middle of the Mediterranean. It's only a few hours away. So you get that pull, not just from young Tunisians who feel they have no stake in their country, but also from people who are coming up through Africa. Of course, also looking again, Tunisia has that big border with Libya.
As he finishes up his trip in Tunisia, he'll be heading to Senegal. And what will be his purpose there?
Two specific purposes, really, in Senegal. One is he'll be attending the Global Partnership for Education. Again, this is the big thing for Emmanuel Macron. Education for everybody, including women. We heard this a couple of months ago when the president was in Burkina Faso. He was talking about the need for women to be given chances to have education. That's a big thing. Security will be key also in this part of the visit. The French would like to see more contributions from the Senegalese, particularly for security in the G5 Sahel region. From the Senegalese side, they want more help for their infrastructure, and the French have been quite keen in giving help, for example, building an airport, building an express railway there. So the two are coming together there. The other visit that France's president will make when he's in Senegal will be to the island of Saint-Louis. It's an island in Senegal that the French have had connection with since the 17th century. They feel very strongly about this island. But in particular, Emmanuel Macron is going there to look at coastal erosion and the effects of climate change. Fishing is integral to the economy of Saint-Louis. And so Emmanuel Macron wants to go there and actually have a look at particularly what effects climate change is having to this area.
That's reporter Catherine Field speaking to VOA's Kim Louise from Paris. That brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Tunga by Radio and Whistle. Radio, whose real name is Moses Sikibogo, died today in Kampala.
Emergency, emergency. When I need a edge, dance a tunga. We so many of us in Kilunga, yeah. Dance a tunga, but in the same old Malumba, yeah.
Tunga, 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 tunga. On the obja, tunga, tunga, tunga,
tunga,
tunga, tunga, tunga, tunga, tunga. On the obja, tunga, tunga, tunga,
tunga.
We have been listening to Radio and Whistle with the song Tunga. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Would like to know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.